Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Thank you for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show. When we're talking about the California Gold Rush of 1849, you know, the minor 49er thing, actually it was 1848. Oregon had an inside track on that gold rush. Portlanders found out about gold a month before New Yorkers and had a much shorter voyage to go to get to the gold fields, so the state nearly emptied out as everyone who could go went. They got there first, and many of them were lucky. It's surprising sometimes how much of early Oregon was actually built with gold rush money. This story was first published on November 5th of 2009, so it's an old one and, you know, shorter and not quite as smooth as my newer ones. But I hope you enjoy it anyway. Here we go. Welcome to Oregon, population 8,779. Has a certain ring, doesn't it? Not even Tom McCall would have welcomed a number that low, but that was the population of the territory of Oregon, including what's now Washington State, according to the census in 1849. A year earlier, there'd been three times as many people there. But of course, you know what happened in 1849. Gold had been discovered in California the year before, and although there was quite a bit of gold in Oregon too, it hadn't been discovered yet. So southward flew virtually every Oregon citizen capable of putting dirt in a pan and pouring water over it. Crops rotted in the fields. For a whole lot of them, though, it was worth it. You see, Oregonians had learned of the gold discovery well before anyone back east, and that was primarily because of a sea captain who made a killing in Portland. The captain had sailed his ship, the Honolulu, into port the previous July, just a few months after gold was discovered. Portlanders thought it odd that he brought the ship in empty with nothing to sell to them. They were, by the way, quite peeved about that. Portland was a very remote outpost at the time, and everyone really looked forward to a trading ship arriving. A couple of months after that, ships in ballast coming to Portland to take loads of wheat and other foodstuffs across the sea would be very common, but in mid-1848, they were not. Portlanders found it odder, too, that the captain zipped out and started snapping up every pick and shovel he could find all over town, and then when it was time to pay for his excavation equipment, they found out what he was up to. He paid for it with gold dust, and then he told them where he'd gotten it. Actually, some of his men told them where he'd gotten it, and they taxed him with it, and he confessed. He had planned on just leaving and keeping the secret to himself. Can't really blame him, I don't suppose. Well, by the time the New York Herald got the word and announced it for the first time on the eastern seaboard on August 19th, Oregonians had already been pouring over the border to the gold fields for a month. By the time the first ships crammed with gold rushers got to San Francisco Bay 8 months later, remember there was no Panama Canal yet, they had to do what they called going around the Horn. They had to sail around Patagonia. So the Oregonians, by that time, had already spent most of a very productive summer and autumn scrounging up the, quote, easy pickings and staking out their pick of available claims. When they returned to their neglected farms, these Oregonians brought back millions in gold, if they were lucky. If they were unlucky, of course, you know what they brought back. But they found the folks who'd stayed behind had done almost as well as they had. One couldn't eat gold. Somebody had to grow food. And so many of the people who usually do that were digging for gold that there wasn't much food, so prices were astronomical. Ship after ship loaded with Willamette Valley food headed down to San Francisco and brought back even more gold. Before 1848, Oregon's economy, such as it was barter-based. The Provisional Territorial Legislature even voted to make wheat legal tender at one point. And Territorial Governor George Abernathy gave out special rocks as change at his store. They were known, possibly not fondly, as Abernathy rocks. But once all this gold started pouring in, suddenly business owners needed scales to weigh gold dust, and a group of citizens started stamping it into $5 and $10 beaver money, and business got quite a lot easier to do. By the way, if you ever run across one of those beaver money coins, they are extremely valuable today. Much more valuable than the gold they're made of. Well, as the California gold fields filled up with Easterners and treasure seekers from around the world, most of the Oregonians came home. Some got skunked, but many returned with pockets bulging, and all of them found that they could almost name their price for anything they could grow. Now that mining the mines was no longer particularly profitable, Oregonians found they could do even better by mining the miners. One other thing happened in 48 as well. Oregon lost its preeminence on the West Coast. In early 1848, there were only 1,000 or so non-Native Americans in California, and many times that in the Oregon Territory. Of course, California had just stopped being part of Mexico at the time. But the following year, the ratios would be reversed, irrevocably reversed, and Oregon would never again have a bigger population than its sunnier southerly neighbor. That's it for today. Before I cue up the outro, though, I want to remind you guys that I'm going to be doing a history show presentation with vintage photographs and pop culture wisecracks and stuff like that on the farcical and ridiculous but nonetheless frightening history of the Ku Klux Klan in the great state of Oregon in the 1920s, the rise and fall of the Kluxes, as I like to call them. This is a history show in a bar with beer and all kinds of things like that. It starts at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, August 6th, at the Jack London Bar, corner of 4th and Alder Streets in downtown Portland, in the basement of the historic Rialto Pool Room. So I hope to see you there, and if you come, please do introduce yourself. Well, that's it for our show for today. This show is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone reader, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a couple other minor components. Photographs and other images that go with today's show are on offbeatoregon.com, where you'll also find full citations to the sources used in writing this story, along with more than 200 other articles written over the last 5 years, all organized by date of publication. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do Offbeat Oregon for learning and for fun, so I don't sell advertising or ask for donations, but if you feel a need to make a donation anyway, may I suggest that you buy a copy of my book instead? It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, published by the History Press in 2012. You can order it from the store link on offbeatoregon.com if you'd like, but if you still have a local community bookstore in your town, I hope you'll consider buying it from them instead. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in Corvallis, drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee and talk about history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Don't be a stranger, especially don't be a stranger if you have a good idea for one of these columns in the future. Speaking of the future, our next show will be coming your way at around 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.